Imagine reading the speeches of like history's most radical revolutionary, you know, the kind of figure who completely upends the status quo.
Right, someone who just changes everything.
Exactly. But then you realize that 10% of everything they said was actually just a direct quote from an ancient dusty library.
It totally shifts how you view them. Yeah.
It really does. Anyway, welcome to the deep dive. Today we are looking at this massive textual analysis of the Christian Gospels. And just to set the ground rules for you right up front, regardless of your personal theological background, our mission today is to just take an impartial, objective look at the source text itself.
Yeah, we're really just analyzing the mechanics here, how this historical figure, Jesus of Nazareth, actually constructed his message.
Right, and the data we're looking at is just staggering. I mean, out of the roughly 1,800 verses recording his direct speech across the four Gospels, about 180 of them are direct quotations or, you know, clear allusions to the Old Testament.
Which is a full 10%.
Yeah. Okay, let's unpack this because this isn't just some dry religious text study. This is literally a masterclass in how ancient history was utilized as a blueprint for the future.
To visualize what that actually looks like,
Right?
I want you to imagine standing in the center of this ancient, really expansive library. Just picture massive stone walls lined entirely with centuries-old parchment scrolls.
Yeah.
You know, Genesis, Leviticus, Isaiah, the
These
Psalms.
files and aisles of ancient text.
Exactly. And what this material reveals is that Jesus didn't just walk into this room and occasionally pull a scroll off the shelf for a little splash of inspiration.
Like a quick quote to sound smart.
Right.
No.
No, he viewed this entire library as an unbroken, unified narrative that pointed directly to him. So our goal today is to uncover the underlying mechanics of that. We really want to understand the why behind these connections.
Why rely so heavily on these specific ancient texts to make incredibly radical new points? Well, before we can even get into his famous moral teachings, I feel like we have to establish how he viewed history itself. Because in our modern era, we tend to look at ancient history as, I don't know, a collection of cautionary
Oh,
tales.
just interesting mythology, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But the texts indicate he saw history as an absolute literal precedent for human behavior. I mean, when he talked about the end of the world, he didn't invent some abstract, scary scenario out of thin air.
No, he pointed straight back to the book of Genesis.
Right.
He cited the corruption that preceded Noah's flood in Genesis 6 and the sudden destruction that fell on Lot's generation in Genesis 19.
He brought it right back to the beginning.
He did. He treated these historical events as literal templates for eschatological judgment.
Which means, like, the ultimate end of the world reckoning.
Exactly. In his framework, the past wasn't just prologue. It was the direct, unalterable template for the future cosmic reality. The mechanism of judgment had already been established in antiquity.
And that reliance on the earliest possible history, it comes into play with daily social issues too. Like, there's this really fascinating debate captured in these texts about marriage and divorce.
Oh, yeah, the trap they tried to set for him.
Yes. He gets cornered by these religious leaders who want him to weigh in on a heated legal debate of the day. And they bring up this specific law from Moses in the book of Deuteronomy, which basically established the legal framework for a man to write a certificate of divorce.
Right, which was the unquestioned law of the land for centuries.
What's fascinating here is how he maneuvers out of that legal trap, because he doesn't engage in a debate over the minutiae of that specific Mosaic law at all.
He completely bypasses Deuteronomy.
Exactly. He tells the religious leaders that Moses only permitted that legal loophole as a concession because of their, quote, hardness of heart.
He just dismisses the centuries-old legal standard.
Yeah, he reverts entirely back to the original creation narrative of Adam and Eve in Genesis.
Yeah.
He argues for the absolute permanence of marriage based on how humans were originally designed.
Which scholars actually referred to as a hierarchical hermeneutic?
Right, meaning a system of interpretation where certain foundational texts just pull rank over others. It's like a Supreme Court justice completely bypassing a recent lower court ruling or, you know, even a long-standing piece of legislation to go straight back to the original intent of the Constitution's framers.
That's a great analogy.
He's basically looking at these religious leaders and saying, I don't care about the amendments you've made to accommodate your own flaws. We are going back to page one, paragraph one, to see how this was supposed to function before you broke it.
He was penetrating right through layers of cultural tradition to retrieve the original spirit and intent of the scriptures. And he stated his foundational premise clearly in the Gospel of John, basically asserting that the scriptures could not be broken.
So the original precedent wins out.
Always. By anchoring his argument in Genesis rather than Deuteronomy, he was ensuring that the absolute original precedent superseded any later flawed human concessions.
Okay, so if he is perfectly willing to override a law given by Moses by pointing back to the dawn of creation, how does he handle the daily, rigorous laws that actually govern society at the time?
Because it was a lot of laws.
Oh, yeah. Ancient Judea was a culture completely micromanaged by hundreds of meticulous statutes. It wasn't just a few broad ideas. It was a highly complex legal code touching like every aspect of daily life, diet, commerce.
And he synthesized that massive, complex legal code down to its absolute essence. We see this most famously articulated in the Sermon on the Mount.
Right.
He takes hundreds of distinct statutes and just distills them into the Great Commandment. He draws the primary obligation, which is to love God with all your heart, soul, and might, directly from the Shema, a really famous prayer in Deuteronomy 6.
But then he pairs it with something else.
He does. He stitches it together with a secondary command from a completely different context. In Leviticus 19, love thy neighbor as thyself.
And he declares that all the law and the prophets hang entirely on those two positive obligations. Which is, you know, an incredibly efficient way to summarize a massive legal library.
It really is.
But distilling the law didn't mean he was softening it, right? Because when people tried to use the letter of the law to avoid the spirit of the law, he was intensely strict. The texts highlight his reaction to this loophole called the Corban Vow.
Oh, the Corban Vow is such a perfect example of legalism masking cruelty.
Walk us through that one.
Well, in that culture, you have to remember, there was no social safety net. Aging parents relied entirely on their adult children for survival. But certain individuals were dedicating their money and assets to the temple as a, quote, gift to God.
And that's what Corban means, right? A gift.
Exactly. So by officially declaring their wealth sacred, they conveniently made those funds legally unavailable to use for caring for their aging parents.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were using a pious-sounding religious law as basically a tax shelter to evade a fundamental moral duty.
And he brings the absolute hammer down on this practice. I mean, he doesn't just offer a mild critique of their selfishness. He pulls a severe civil law from the books of Exodus and Leviticus, reminding them that the original penalty for cursing your father or mother was
death.
Yeah, literally death. He takes the absolute gravity of the ancient legal code and uses it to completely shatter their modern convenient loopholes.
He absolutely refused to let cultural traditions nullify the core divine mandate of compassion. But, you know, the most radical shift in his handling of the law happens during what scholars call the antitheses in Matthew 5.
The "you have heard that it was said, but I say to you" pattern.
That's the one. In this sequence, he systematically moves the sphere of obedience from external observable actions to internal psychological dispositions.
So murder becomes anger. The original law in Exodus is a super clear boundary, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
But he steps in and says, if you are even harboring anger against your brother, you are subject to the same judgment.
Right. And adultery becomes lust. Just looking at someone with intent is morally equivalent to the physical act.
He even reworks the whole concept of retaliation. We've all heard eye for an eye,
which is known as lex talionis from the book of Exodus. And it's important to understand that eye for an eye wasn't originally prescribed as a mandate for revenge.
It wasn't.
No, it was a judicial cap. It was designed to stop endless blood feuds in the ancient world. So if someone knocked out your tooth, your clan didn't have the legal right to go and burn down their entire village in response.
So the retaliation had to be strictly proportional.
Exactly.
But he takes that judicial limitation, which was meant for civil courts, and restricts its application entirely to the personal realm by mandating total non-resistance to injury. He tells them to love their enemies, which completely expands the definition of neighbor from Leviticus to include the very Roman soldiers who are occupying and persecuting them.
That's a massive paradigm shift.
Okay, I have to push back on this concept a bit. Doesn't moving the goalpost from just don't murder anyone to don't even be angry set humanity up for absolute guaranteed failure? I mean, a checklist is manageable, right? If the law is just don't steal, don't murder, a highly disciplined person might actually pull that off over a lifetime. But demanding perfect internal thoughts, total non-resistance to an invading army. It sounds like a terrible legislative strategy if the goal is actual human compliance.
I get that. And it sounds impossible because, according to this analysis, it is impossible.
Okay, really? That's the point.
The sheer impossibility of this ethical perfection is the actual point of the Sermon on the Mount. It reveals the complete inadequacy of human capability. I mean, if you believe you can achieve righteousness merely through external compliance, then yeah, a checklist works.
Right.
But if the baseline standard is absolute internal perfection, a checklist is utterly useless. This structural intensity isn't meant to be just a new list of rules. It demands a fundamental theological transition.
Okay, that makes sense.
The impossible ethical perfection demanded here actually requires a mechanism of divine enablement, something that had been promised much earlier in the prophetic tradition.
Because if you just drop the Sermon on the Mount on a crowd of people, they are completely paralyzed. You have to provide the mechanism to actually achieve it. And this brings us right into the concept of the New Covenant.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The realization of this impossible internal standard required a total transformation of the covenant relationship itself. So he established what is known as the New Covenant, and he linked his work to a very specific foundational prophecy in the book of Jeremiah.
And the word search data on this is incredible, by the way. The term New Covenant appears exactly once in the entirety of the Old Testament.
Just one time.
Yeah, just once, in Jeremiah 31.
And that single passage promises a complete replacement for the old Mosaic legal system. The text promises that God will eventually write his law directly on the, quote, inward parts, essentially wiring it right into the human heart. And Jesus explicitly linked his own actions, specifically the breaking of bread and pouring of wine at the Last Supper, to this exact solitary prophecy. This internal rewiring is the proposed mechanism that actually makes the heart-level obedience of the Sermon on the Mount possible.
So it was an internal upgrade.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Furthermore, Jeremiah 31 promises the complete radical forgiveness of all previous failures to keep the law.
Here's where it gets really interesting. If this new covenant is the ultimate solution, like the historical upgrade that finally fixes the internal flaw of humanity, why does he spend the majority of his public ministry teaching it in cryptic riddles?
You mean the parables?
Yeah, he's talking about sowing seeds, pulling weeds, and finding hidden pearls. If you hold the key to the ultimate historical upgrade, why use parables? Why not just state the mechanism plainly so everyone can get on board?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we see that parables were not just quaint illustrations for rural farmers.
They weren't.
No, they were a conscious fulfillment of a historical mandate. He explicitly states his reasoning in the Gospel of Luke by quoting the prophet Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 6, the prophet is given a very strange commission of judicial veiling.
Veiling?
Yeah, he's told to preach to the people, but in a way that actually hardens their hearts and conceals the truth.
So communicating in a way that intentionally hides the reality of the kingdom from people who are already hostile to it.
That is the mechanism at work, yes. He used parables to confirm the prophetic judgment that the kingdom would initially remain hidden from those who actively rejected his authority.
He is picking up the exact mandate given to Isaiah centuries prior.
Precisely. But even within that intentional veiling, he is constantly weaponizing ancient imagery to subvert their current expectations.
And the mustard seed is the perfect example of this subversion, isn't it?
It really is. In the Old Testament, specifically in prophets like Ezekiel and Daniel Great, world-conquering empires are constantly symbolized by massive, towering cedar trees that shelter the nations in their branches.
Right, big, strong trees.
Exactly. So the first century audience was eagerly expecting a military messiah to plant a new, towering cedar that would completely crush the Roman occupation. But Jesus takes that deeply entrenched geopolitical expectation and just flips it.
He compares the kingdom of God not to a towering, violent cedar, but to a tiny, humble mustard seed.
Which grows slowly, almost invisibly.
Into what is essentially a large, unruly weed. It's a total subversion of what they expected divine power to look like. And he gets incredibly pointed with this subversion in the parable of the wicked tenants, too.
Oh, yes.
He retells Isaiah's Song of the Vineyard. In the original text of Isaiah 5, the vineyard is explicitly, clearly identified as the house of Israel. But Jesus retells this famous story to the religious leaders, and he updates the ending.
He casts himself right into the narrative.
He casts himself in the story as the landlord's only son, the rightful heir who is dragged out of the vineyard and murdered by the tenants. He is taking their own treasured history and telling them right to their faces that they are about to execute the climax of their long tradition of rejecting God's messengers.
He is leveraging history to explain his present unfolding reality. Jesus didn't just teach about history from a safe distance, you know. He actively reenacted it. He utilized the Old Testament as a literal moment-by-moment script for his own life and ultimately his execution.
This shifts the perspective entirely for me. We aren't just looking at a philosopher passing down wisdom. We are looking at someone intentionally embodying the historical destiny of an entire nation.
Yes.
Like when his family flees as refugees to Egypt when he's a child, the texts note, this fulfills a prophecy in Hosea, out of Egypt have I called my son.
And critically, that passage in Hosea originally described the entire nation of Israel being led out of slavery during the Exodus. By mapping his own childhood onto that text, Jesus is typologically identifying himself as the one who will succeed where the nation of Israel historically failed.
Ill connected.
It is. But the sheer density of this textual reliance really peaks during the Passion narratives, the brutal events surrounding his betrayal, trial, and crucifixion.
Yeah, he maps his own betrayal by a close friend directly to the righteous sufferer narrative in the Psalms. He quotes Psalm 41, "Mine own familiar friend hath lifted up his heel against me." He understands exactly the mechanics of what is happening to him, and he anchors the psychological trauma of betrayal right to the ancient text.
The physical and psychological reality of what happens next is so crucial to understand. The two most powerful citations of the Old Testament occur while he is actually suffocating on the cross.
It's really heavy.
It is. His cry of dereliction, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, is a direct verbatim quote of the opening line of Psalm 22.
Which, if you just hear that out of context, it sounds like a cry of absolute devastating defeat. Just the realization that he has failed. But we have to look at the entire trajectory of Psalm 22 to understand the mechanism of why he quoted it in that specific moment.
Exactly. By using the last of his breath to quote the opening line, he consciously claimed the entire narrative arc of that specific psalm.
And what is that arc?
Well, Psalm 22 begins with horrific physical suffering, public mockery, and profound spiritual isolation. But it does not end there. The text moves rapidly from utter abandonment to a promise of global kingship, eternal vindication, and the inclusion of all nations in worship.
So it's ultimately victorious.
Yes. By anchoring his physical agony in the specific poetry, he signifies to anyone listening that his suffering was not a tragic, unforeseen mistake. It was a pre-scripted, absolutely necessary path to an eventual triumphant reign.
And his final breath confirms this trajectory. He doesn't just quietly succumb to the trauma. He cries out, "Into thine hand I commit my spirit," which is another direct quote, this time from Psalm 31. It proves his death was an intentional, voluntary commitment to a plan.
Right.
So what does this all mean? I keep thinking it's like a modern software developer who is building a completely revolutionary, world-changing application. But when you look under the hood at the source code, you realize the new app only functions because it is perfectly executing a piece of foundational legacy code written decades or even centuries prior.
That is a brilliant way to look at it.
He isn't erasing the old code. He's the only one who finally compiled it correctly.
This raises an important question concerning the human mind. I mean, what does it take for a person to possess that level of ultimate sense of purpose and destiny?
Seriously.
To be able to look at one's own betrayal, physical torture, and imminent death, not as chaotic bad luck, but as the deliberate, victorious climax of ancient history. The analysis of these texts overwhelmingly confirms that Jesus affirmed the historical reliability and absolute authority of the Old Testament in all its components.
The ancient laws, the historical narratives, the prophetic poetry.
All of it. And then he offered his own physical body as the living culmination of those dreams.
We started today by asking how this revolutionary figure grounded his message. And the answer reveals an unbroken, unified narrative. I mean, he didn't merely borrow a few good ethical ideas from antiquity. He used foundational histories from Genesis to define absolute truth for the future. He synthesized the daily grind of Leviticus and Deuteronomy to demand an impossible standard of internal perfection. He utilized the new covenant promised in Jeremiah to provide the actual mechanism to achieve that perfection. And he physically embodied the prophetic suffering outlined in the Psalms, reciting the legacy code of his ancestors with his dying breaths.
The relationship between his radical new teachings and the older texts is just characterized by profound, unbroken continuity. The Old Testament basically served as the mechanism to educate the ancient world for the reception of a specific intervention.
Right.
And according to the framework of these texts, Jesus delivered that intervention through the conscious, methodical fulfillment of those exact ancient words.
You know, it is incredibly easy in our modern era to feel completely overwhelmed by information overload.
Oh, absolutely.
You open your phone and you are immediately drowning in isolated facts, disconnected news cycles, and endless data points that just feel like random noise. Nothing seems to connect. But what this deep dive into the source text shows is the sheer power of a deeply integrated worldview.
A framework where ancient history, rigorous law, and intense personal action are perfectly aligned.
Exactly. It's a reality where every single piece of the library matters and absolutely nothing is wasted.
That underlying coherence really challenges our modern tendency to view human history as merely a sequence of random, disconnected events driven by chaos.
Which leaves you with a final thought to mull over as you go about your day. If this historical figure viewed the entirety of ancient history, the obscure property laws, the fallen ancient kingdoms, the poetic cries of anguish from forgotten kings, as a unified, unbroken script pointing directly to his own actions in the present moment. Well, how does that framework change the way you view the unfolding of our own historical moments today?
It's a huge question.
Are we just living through a series of random, chaotic events that signify nothing? Or is there an underlying narrative waiting to be fulfilled? If 10% of his radical vision for the future was built entirely on a blueprint of the past, what does that mean for the legacy code we are writing today? Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.